So today I'm in Broxbourne with Lord Brian Davies. He's kindly agreed to see me today. So the first question most people will be asking is, how am I here? So do we have any mutual friends or acquaintances?
Well, we obviously do. I don't know all Sarah's friends and acquaintances, but I know Sarah well enough from when she was first born, because of course the Hindmarshes have lived two doors away from us for 40 years. And we therefore know the full lives of their children as they know the full lives of ours. They've got two and we've got three. And they've all gone different paths. The five children have pursued different careers and are very different characters in many ways. But we've always all got on well together.
And the next question, because this is a Vicar's Tea Drinking Project, is, do you like tea?
Not a great deal. I drink strong tea on occasions where it's the obvious thing to do because everybody else is drinking tea. But it's not my first choice. Now, I drink coffee in the morning and thirst quenches, and when I come home and after an hour's travel on trains, I'm much more likely to go for soft drinks and so on than tea. Mm-hmm. Tea falls short for me on the whole.
There are quite a few people I've spoken to, including the Bishop of Swindon, who doesn't really like tea, but will drink tea if the situation demands
it. And it frequently does. I mean, when I was on the campaign trail as an MP seeking votes and so on, I contested a seat in South Wales at Newport, and you can't get past the Welsh doorway without going through it and having tea. And of course, let me say, that's got a slight downside to it. First of all, their tea always includes some Welsh cake as a larva bread or something, so eating too much. And secondly, of course, you're out on your own in residential areas, and you can't drink 6 gallons of tea without looking for the nearest lavatory, which is usually miles away.
The question which I'm asking everybody is this question, which appeared in the Telegraph 2 years ago, which said, Christianity in the UK is not dying but sleeping. And I wondered how you responded to that.
Well, sleeping, I don't... That seems like a euphemism to me. I mean, I think Christianity is obviously in decline, because we look at the figures of church attendance and how many people commit themselves strongly to Christianity. That doesn't alter the fact that on the big occasions like the royal wedding the other day, everybody expects it to be held in a church or cathedral or a grand ecclesiastical building, and they wouldn't think it was proper if it wasn't held there. But I mean, I think this is largely the age of rationality, and I've always thought from quite a young age, really, that Christianity's got difficulty in facing up to some very clear questions that rational people would put to it.
I think part of the project of what I've been doing has been partly thinking about those. I'm talking to scientists. I have a scientific background myself. There are other people who have scientific backgrounds who are Christians. But actually, what people believe and rationality and scientific method and how you apply that on how you interpret Christian traditions and the Bible is something that I think people are still struggling with, whether that's something which can happen or not.
I mean, for me, it's... I can't understand the Christian religion's commitment to the Old Testament. I mean, I regard the Old Testament as largely a barbaric book. And it seems to me it sets out to prove one thing, that there is a God who's got one people and he's given them land and they've got one holy city. Well, that, even in ancient times, that seems to me to be an extremely narrow theological and philosophical base. And in the contemporary age, I just merely weep for the Palestinians and for the horrors of the Middle East, and I think Israel's responsible for some of it.
Are you the rationalist who would actually say, I think Christianity should die in the UK?
Yes, I'm in favour of people learning a morality which is high as Christian morality, which I hugely admire, and I was brought up on it. I recognise the morality of Christianity, and I want our society to be based on moral principles like it. But I don't look to religion as forging that path. In fact, what I detest really is when religion gets in the way of it. I cannot understand the Catholic Church's position on abortion. To say to a woman that we're telling you what your choice is, you pay the penalty of the fact you've got pregnant, you pay the penalty, and you've just got to get on with it. That may have been necessary way, way back in time when you've got to make sure that human life survived and so many babies died. I mean, Queen Anne had about 15 children, of whom a dozen of them died. But in our day and age, there's no question that women have got the right of choice over what happens to their bodies. And
it's sometimes said that the Labour Party grew from Methodist church activism. Can you think of times when Christianity or other faiths have had positive effects on politics in recent years?
Well, the actual phrase, of course, was the Labour Party owes as much to Methodism as it does to Marx. And that was a repudiation of those who were on the far left of the party, who were placing themselves too close to the Communist Party, and particularly at the time when the Russian Revolution was only a decade old or so, and it was to show that the Labour Party had different origins from just Marxism. I've no doubt that Marxism has had an influence upon Labour, but Methodism clearly has done in the United Kingdom. I mean, I grew up in a Methodist household, I share an office with an Anglican, very devout. He goes to church every Sunday, and we have endless arguments on these things. But he will always maintain, well, of course, you're a socialist, but you're only a socialist because, in fact, what you actually believe in are Christian values.
It's very interesting. I think I'm concerned about rationalism and scientific method and the things that it is appropriate to apply rationalism to and the things which are not appropriate for rational treatment. And I think we're not very good at working out necessarily what they are sometimes as a society. And the other thing which concerns me is that there seems to be a kind of acceptance amongst some people that the truth isn't important anymore.
Ah, and well, there I agree with you.
And then the whole collapse of meta-narrative and all those questions.
Awful. Oh, we're in danger. Yeah.
Which is bigger.
Sure. Well, of course, it's also the development of our technology, which actually makes this grab for falsehood possible. You've got people who've got the ability to be false and command the airwaves to an excessive extent, and I agree with that entirely, and I am worried about those features of our contemporary society which seems to suggest that facts aren't sacred, that there's no such thing as a fact. You can believe what you believe, and if I, President Trump, say things are so, the only rational response to it is to say, yes, President Trump, you're the fount of all wisdom. Well, I find that a difficult concept.
I'm going to talk to you now about social mobility and ask you some questions about it. So my personal background of this is that when my grandfather, who had started off as a miner in North Shields and then retrained in North Shields and then retrained as a bricklayer and moved to Reading, when they were in Reading in the mid-1930s, his next door neighbour said to him, all your grandchildren will go to university. And he laughed in their face. And we did.
We all did. How many of you are there?
There's four of us.
And you all went to university.
We all went to university.
Oh, a very bright family.
And
so we were all educated in the 50s.
Well, we were all educated a bit later. So I started at school here in Broxbourne in 1982. And so I went through, I was the last year to get a grant. But we all went to university, but I am, and the circles in which I move now are very, very different from my grandparents' circles. So my mother's side of the family, her dad was a self-educated mechanic, and they had egg and chips for supper on Friday night because you could get eggs and potatoes from the milkman, and my grandfather would bring home his wages on Friday night, and you could pay the milkman on Saturday morning.
Yeah, and Friday night was a big night.
So he brought home the wages and they would pay the milkman on Saturday morning for what they'd eaten on Friday night. So that was a huge social mobility.
Yes,
but I'm
right.
not sure if that's possible in the same way in the 21st century.
Well, I think it is. I think it is. But I think what it is, it was inadequate when you were going through this process and so was I. And it's inadequate today. I mean, there are vast areas of the country and vast towns and cities where the expectations of it. I represented Oldham. Now, of course, we'd got quite a challenge because there are different religions in Oldham. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Christianity is held strongly by some, but Islam is held much more strongly by others. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is an extraordinarily rigorous religion. And there's no half commitment to Islam, it seems to me. You're Muslim or you're not. But the problem in Oldham was that with all those children who weren't ethnic minorities and we'd got to bring on, all the white children as well as set of parents, everybody had blighted expectations because the parents had done nothing. The kids don't expect to do nothing and the schools don't expect the children to do well. It's a land of low expectation. Well, if you get low expectation, you get low results. And of course, the big challenge for our society has been, how do we raise the expectations, not just of the few, but all the children to achieve the highest that they can. And they will get on to higher things. If you go to a place, Stoke-on-Trent, go to Stoke-on-Trent. Kids do not achieve in Stoke-on-Trent. They just don't. And it's not, well, the schools don't try and the staff have got the same ideals as others and so on. It's a dead weight of limited expectation and the fact that the families expect the kids to get out and be earning their living by the time they're 16. And they've got to come away from it all. Now, that was prevalent in this society that you and I grew up. Large numbers of people thought that. And you and I were lucky that we had different influences on us. But it's still there in our society strongly.
I think for me, the influence of mid-20th century socialism on my parents was that they were aspirational for their children. They believed that their children could be better educated and get further than they could. And I don't think anyone's necessarily got hold of that in the same way in society at the moment.
No, well, there's pockets of that belief. I mean, in the Labour Party, I'm always meeting people who are parents who are exactly like you and like you and I are, and like our parents were. That's one of the joys of being in the party, that you're meeting people who have got hopes and aspirations and want to build a better world than the one we've got and are dissatisfied with what is so grotesquely unfair about the world we live in at the present time.
What would you like to be remembered for?
Well, you gave me notice of that question.
I did.
And I stumbled then, and I'm going to stumble now, because I think on the whole, politicians like to say at moments like that, great things which they've achieved. Well, I've been in politics since, I was one of the youngest candidates in the country in 1966, and I've advanced the cause of what I think have been right values all the time. We're Westminster takes big decisions.
I have realised that my iPad has auto-corrected my very last question, because it is meant to say, what is your favourite thing which begins with T, with the letter rather than...
Oh, the letter T. Well, I know what it was when I was a child, Thomas the Tank Engine. And I think, probably, I've always liked trains. I like historic, you know, I like the railways that we've preserved, the heritage railways. And we went up on the Scottish Heritage Line last year, and we indulge now and again every 3 or 4 years have a ride on a steam train in some of those spots. And I think Thomas the Tank Engine probably set me down that track, and he's always brought fun to me. Trains always bring fun to me. So Portillo's thing, which the other, and I clashed with Portillo because he came to speak in Broxbourne Civic Centre. I didn't clash with him. I warned him beforehand. I said, I'll be asking him, not a political one. He said, no. I said, no, it won't be political. But he was really wary. All the people who'd asked questions before I did all asked questions about his trains experience, how he did this series and what he'd liked best and all that kind of stuff, and did he like doing this cooking and all this stuff. And I asked him a question which I'd never heard anybody answer satisfactorily. And he produced easily the best answer I've ever heard. I asked him, why is it that the American multimillionaires feel an obligation to endow their town and their state and the public provision in their area with huge benefactions? And why are the British super rich so bloody hopeless at that? We haven't had anybody since Carnegie, and Carnegie was an honorary Canadian by the time he died.
Absolutely.
Portillo said, Brian, he said, we've clashed often enough at Westminster, which made all the audience laugh. And he said, but I'm just going to say to you, you need to think this through, he said. The difference, of course, is that we're a small island and they're a great continent. Politicians in the United States belong, they both represent, but they also belong, even if they're not politicians, but just very wealthy people. They belong to their state and their city. British people belong to Britain. And he's right. He is right. It's because the Rockefellers and the other Rockefellers endowed New York, because Rockefeller was a New Yorker. We haven't got that feeling.
We don't have that identity.
Not at all. We've got no identity like that at all. And, of course, it's a difference between a continent which has created of expanding states and Britain, which has been a uniform society, really, for 1,000 years.
Although we have locally some trusts which pay for people who live within, give grants to people within our parish boundary, which is very local.
Oh, very local. The United States can't match us in charitable kind of. They haven't got institutions which are charities in the same way. What they've got is universities and public libraries and welfare things like that that you can put money into. But they haven't got charities. Well, no other. You see, no European country's got charities like we've got. And, of course, some of our very wealthy people give big slices of money, don't they, to charities. It's just that charities, there are local charities, of course, but the big money charities are national, aren't they?
Thank you very much for seeing me today in Broxbourne, Lord Davis.
It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed it very much.